one of the larger stores in the United States, and volume-wise. But again, for me, it was a step down in volume, but allowed me to explore different experiences. And I was able to get into buying, which had already always had been a dream of mine. And yeah, it also allowed me to get into events. So it's interesting that retailtainment is a big buzzword right now in the industry. And honestly, it's been around my whole life, right? It's a way in which retail is kind of, you know, inventing itself now.
Voices with value. Stories with soul. Tools for transformation. This is Innovation Insights. Innovate so you do not stagnate. Welcome to another episode of Innovation Insights, where we dive deep into the minds shaping the future of industries through innovation, creativity, and groundbreaking research. We believe that innovation happens in all aspects of life. I am your host, Dr. Yolanda Sanders. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Dr. Amy Shane Nichols to the podcast. She is a dynamic educator, leader, and innovator with over 3 decades of experience in retail, marketing, and education. Dr. Shane Nichols is an assistant professor in design, merchandising, and textiles at the University of Wyoming. Her career spans 30 plus years in retail management, 19 years in licensed product and brand management, 12 years in retail event and marketing management, and a decade of impactful college level teaching. She's known for her decisive leadership, motivational skills, and ability to drive measurable results in million-dollar retail operations, brand development, or academic initiatives. Amy holds a PhD in apparel, merchandising, and design from Iowa State University, an MBA in marketing from the University of Iowa, and a bachelor's degree in marketing from Iowa State University. Her research dives into the symbolic expression of identity through apparel, and she's contributed to numerous conferences and scholarly publications exploring consumer behavior, branding, and retail innovation. Beyond the impressive credentials, Amy is recognized for her professionalism, positivity, and high ethical standards. She brings passion, creativity, and a deep commitment to excellence. Whether leading a student-run retail store, managing multi-million-dollar sales volumes, or mentoring the next generation of retail and marketing leaders. Get ready for an insightful conversation packed with wisdom on leadership, innovation, brand management, and the power of storytelling through apparel and retail. Amy, welcome to the Innovation Insights podcast. I'm so happy to have you here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Oh, of course. It's joy to reconnect with you. We used to work together at your former university, and it's really just nice to see everything that you're doing at the University of Wyoming and catch up with you on those items. So thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Tell us about your career, because you have had quite the career. And I know that when we worked together, I used to always say to you, when I grow up, I want to be Amy Shane Nichols.
I'm trying never to grow up.
That's why I want to be you. Thank you. You have fun every place that you are. But tell us about your career, and because you've been from retail management to academia.
Yeah, so I started in retail right out of high school. It was my first job. Yeah, during high school, I babysat. But my first job was at a department store in Iowa. And I loved it. Absolutely loved it. And yeah, I was just hooked right from the gate. So I was with the department store for a majority of my life, actually. And it was a great experience. They had great training programs. Learned a lot in my position within that company, which is really providing useful today, even still. And yeah, so up until 2005, I was with that particular department store. And then I switched to a new department store for a brief time. That was fantastic for my career in the aspect that I helped open a brand new store in a brand new market and to bring a chain store to a new market. And part of that experience was they brought in like visual merchandisers and VPs from around the United States. And so I was like an intense learning environment for, you know, to open a store. So that was really huge and beneficial to my experience as well that I draw on quite often in class.
Was that Harley Davidson?
Actually, no, Dillard's. I was with Dillard's for a really period of time. Yeah. For my two department stores, which is the great thing about a department store is it houses a lot of categories, right? Women's, men's, etc. It exposes you to a lot of different apparel products, et cetera, right? So I started in the juniors department, again, right out of high school, and went on to a management track. And they moved me from juniors to a new department that they were starting, which was special sizes, petites, fashion plus, dresses, and coats, I think I had there. And then I moved from the corporate office store to a satellite store in Ames, where I used to hire and manage a lot of college students. So working with college students, yeah, I've been doing it for a long time, actually. And there I started in the men's department. And so I have experience fitting men for suits and dress shirts and measuring neck sizes and all of that type of stuff. And then transitioned over to women. At some point, I managed juniors again. I've managed footwear, special sizes a couple times in my life, children. It's often easier for me to say what I haven't done, which is cosmetics, accessories, and intimates. And I never wanted any of them. Yes. But when I was at Dillard's, again, back to the junior department, and they quickly realized that they had not given me all I could handle. They were not using me to my full potential. And so they, within months, gave me the men's department, which was a quarter of the store, I want to say, and double the volume. Yeah. So when they first gave me my assignment in juniors, I giggled. I was like, woohoo, I can do this like on one leg and one hand behind my back. Won't thrill anybody. But quickly caught on. I'm not so sure if I didn't manage shoes while I was there a little bit as well, or if I was just loved shoes so much you could find me in the back room. But yeah.
I love it.
So even in my department store era, I was in a way developing my skills for becoming a professor in the fact that I did a lot of training. So new hire training, customer service training, especially. Yeah. And so I draw on a lot of that now in my teaching position. And then, so yeah. So after those, I went to Harley. Yeah. Which what allowed me to, it was a small store that was, it actually was volume wise was large in the Harley world. It's one of the larger stores in the United States and volume wise. But again, for me, it was a step down in volume. But allowed me to explore different experiences. And I was able to get into buying, which had already always had been a dream of mine. And yeah, it also allowed me to get into events. It's interesting that retailtainment is a big buzzword right now in the industry. And honestly, it's been around my whole life, right? But it's a way in which retail is kind of, you know, inventing itself and stuff now. But yeah, I've been doing that for a very long time. And that's part of what I did at Harley Davidson was I was able to put into play my marketing background and do events and things like that. Yeah. So then I just decided I love the industry so much. And as I said, I've employed college students throughout my life. Oftentimes, retail is their first step into the industry. And I really wanted to share my knowledge and experience and use that to build our industry by bringing in strong candidates. So that is why I pursued an academic position.
That makes sense. both industry and academia. Very fortunate to have you. Very fortunate to have you. Oh my gosh. So you mentioned that you loved retail. Tell us, what do you love about retail?
So I would say it's almost like being a firefighter. I think that's what I used to use an analogy, but that almost sounds bad. Like you're constantly putting out fires. Let me think of a different analogy. No, it's just, it's different every day. It's the same, but it's different every day. That's the thing, right? And like when a firefighter goes to a fire, the fires are all different. So not in a bad perspective, but it's the same, but it's new every day and it's exciting. And especially when you get product in, that might be really what hooked me was new product. It's like having Christmas every day. And being able to touch the fabrics and look at the trims and see what it's made out of. And yeah, just opening new product and learning about new product was probably my biggest buzz.
Oh, that makes sense. You're definitely a product person. And you also have a strong background in product development too, and sourcing. And can you talk a little bit about how you approach product development and work with vendors?
Yeah. So I really developed those skills when I was at Harley, and being able to make your own t-shirt designs for your own types of products. But that's also really where I learned that relationships are a huge part of product development. Yeah. And products in general. You have to have a good working relationship with your vendors and your suppliers. And so building that net, learning how to network and having that interaction. But I love developing products, the creative process of it. I love the creative process. But my background, my undergraduate, and my master's degree are in marketing. So I'm highly sales driven, highly customer service focused. And one of the big things in branding, which is a huge part of product development, is knowing who your consumer is and what they want to buy. Yeah. And so it's the other thing I always liked about retail and product development is the same way. Retail kind of gives you an instant gratification. You can put the clothes out on the rack and you can create that visual display and you can be like, whoops, well, I did a great job. Or, ooh, we might need to rethink that. And yeah, that's probably another big thing that I like about retail is I'm a ladder climber. I'm an achiever and I can set goals for myself and just like daily goals. I'm going to sell like 10 of these TVs today. And it gives me something to strive for the day. And then again, at the end of the day, I can pat myself on the back. I sold 12 or I sold, you know, I beat my goal.
That is really great because you were really talking about setting some metrics and measuring. And there's so many parts of life. We do that in academia. We do it in industry. How do you teach that to students? Because it's not a natural skill. We don't come out of the womb like, okay, let's start setting some goals and let's start looking at our metrics and our OKRs and just what is that?
I think that I've always realized that just your personality can rub off on people. And so I think just being exposed to me and my thinking, I've always believed is been beneficial for people. And I've seen people that I work with start to exhibit those thoughts over time. And so I'm hoping that is happening with students as well. But yeah, even employees that work for me, they'll make comments that they recognize the drivenness. And I'll be like, we only have 5 hours left. We can do it. A motivator. And they're like, Amy, it's 7. I'm like rounding. Like I'll go out and be like, we got 10. We're up to 10. And they're like, it was 9. I'm like, I know, but we're going to have 10. You're on track to get 10. But just having a positive, like motivating attitude and just really trying to get people's awareness to, achievement.
Yeah, that makes sense. This kind of leads into discussion about managing teams in retail, because yes, it is exciting, especially the fashion industry. There's the thought that, oh, it's glamorous and it's fun, but retail is a lot of work and there is pressure. And so how did you manage teams? And then now how do you mentor students too?
Yeah. So I would say that was probably, it's not my strong point. If you looked at my personality profile, because I'm self-motivated and I'm very driven, but I had to learn how to motivate others and I had to learn how to interact with others. And so it wasn't without its shortcomings along the road. And I didn't necessarily work in environments that were very nurturing. Most of my lessons are hard learned and come from people not necessarily being supportive. And so it was learned. The first thing I had to learn was people are people.
Yeah.
And actually, that is really who I am at the core, but I didn't really realize it or come to my true self. I've had to come to my true self over time. And probably the reason I love working in the university environment with students is it allows me to show my compassion. And when you are in a business environment, it's then very fast-paced, numbers-driven, achievement-driven, and there's little room for forgiveness or allowing for mistakes or learning from mistakes, et cetera. And so I would say that's one of the things that I love is that teaching allows me to really be compassionate, which actually is at my core. And I think that's why I was in more conflict when I was in management positions in retail, because I couldn't be truly the human that I am.
That makes sense. Yeah. Industry. And sometimes you don't have the mentors or the coaching or, yeah, industry or academia. It happens in both places.
But along the road, I made a lot of notes about who I didn't want to be like. I didn't want to be.
Oh, I know. You can learn so much that way. Oh, absolutely. So you've worked so much in brand management. What do you feel are some of the key aspects of building a brand today? Either a personal brand or a business brand, a company brand?
Yeah, I think it, again, across the business or a brand or you as a brand, it's the same. In order to stay alive, you have to be able to adapt and innovate and change and move forward, because that's the reality of the world, right? It doesn't matter what industry you're in. However, you still have to be true to yourself. You have to be true to your brand and who you are, right? And those would be the two things that I think change and adapt, but you have to still be true to yourself. And of course, from a business standpoint, you always have to keep your eye on your consumer because they're changing, right? And that will hopefully help you navigate the way in which you need to go.
Yeah, that makes sense. Oh my goodness. In thinking about change, we have a lot of digital changing happening, especially in retail, management, brand, consumer behavior. What are your insights on all the technology and digital media, artificial intelligence, everything that's happening right now for people in building a brand or working in the retail environment? Just what are your thoughts? I mean, there's just a lot happening.
So yeah, digital and technology has propelled so many industries. And again, it's just one of those things that you have to keep your eye on, and you have to make sure that, again, you're open. That if there's anything I've learned in my lifetime and throughout my career is, again, you have to be open to change, and you have to have your eye, nose, ears, you know, everything to the pulse. And see what the pulse is and all of that, figure out how you can adapt and follow that trend. So like right now, everybody has their eye on AI in the industry. And again, you can't, if you're going to survive, you can't just close your eyes and hide under your pillow. You have to get out there and get your feet wet and dive in and make sure that you don't get lost in the dust of it all, really. But from a consumer standpoint, I think you were talking about how you see digital changing, but consumers just change their behaviors. And I also think that consumers are going through a behavior change right now, some behavior changes. What I've noticed throughout my career, over the course of my career, is I was in department store when I started, right? The reason I left that is they were dying. The consumer's pattern was changing. Their behavior was changing, right? They no longer wanted the department store format. They no longer wanted to shop in a mall, right? Look at how many malls are shuttered or struggling still, but redeveloping themselves. And then the consumers have shifted to off-price retailers. And as I show my students in class, you can look at the number top 10 retailers around the world, and that'll give you a very good indication of where your consumers are shopping. It's not that shopping's dying, it's that they're somewhere else, right? And if they're not in your store, you might be in the wrong spot at this time, right? And you might need to reconsider reinventing yourself. But like, even from digital, though, just we were talking about this the other day in my class, just Black Friday, how Black Friday has evolved from digital. When I was in the department stores, I would get up at 6 a.m. to go hand out free pies to customers that spent over X amount of dollars. And then we went through the big hour change and everybody was trying to get the customer's money earlier and earlier on Black Fridays. And then we went into Gray Thursdays, and students were asking me the other day, what did they ask me? Something about the digital thing. And I said, you could watch the transition, right? Black Fridays are still huge sales, right? But the behavior is different. More of it is now digital. They're still sales are still there, but again, consumer behavior has just changed. And also now some of it's even spread out over the course of the month instead of all concentrated in one day. Yeah. And so the sales are still there. They're just different. The behavior is just different. And the technologies do influence consumers' behaviors. Being able to have a 3D model or of yourself, all sorts of technology has an impact on our behavior in this industry, really.
What are your thoughts about talking about behaviors and ways of shopping? Shopping on TikTok, shopping on Instagram. There's live shopping now. We've seen QVC, that type of shopping on TV, but now that is happening on TikTok, TikTok Live and things. And, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, again, it's influencing a generation. Yeah. And I'm doing a study right now that I think that's having an influence. I think it might end up being a finding, potentially. But yeah, definitely. But even just, and this has been a reality for a while, omnichannel, multichannel, selling on sorts of platforms, and it's been adapting. And again, being in the industry, I remember people, again, change. Are you going to follow it? Are you going to resist it? Are you going to embrace it? What is your approach? And survival of the fittest, it weeds people out, right? But even that's evolved since I've been in the industry. I remember people were just, it was a big thing to have a website and all of a sudden have e-commerce. And look at us now, folks. Look at us now, folks. We're selling to people on our phone.
Oh, I know. I mean, you have to have at least one website or more.
Yeah, where you have to go where the customer is, and you have to follow their trends. And that is my passion, consumer behavior. Yep.
Also thinking about consumers, part of that is the symbolic expression of identity through dress, and that has been an area of your research, but did it really initially spark with your work at Harley Davidson?
No. Oh, my dissertation stemmed from my work at Harley, yes.
Okay.
But my focus on consumers stems from my lifetime in sales. And management.
But how about the symbolic expression of identity? Where did that interest stem from?
Yeah, that really did come from Harley and then manifested into my dissertation. Again, from a sales perspective, Harley-Davidson consumer behavior was changing. And I wanted to know more about that behavior and what drives their behavior. And so I chose to look at female Harley-Davidson riders and what drives their consumption of apparel. And part of that was identity. Wanted to see the identity base of it because previous research had been done, some seminal research, some of the original, what they talked about Harley, and it had looked at male riders, and they had found that identity was part of their consumption behavior. So I wanted to see if women were similar.
So are they?
That, yes, they are similar to men and male riders in the fact that they do consume the apparel in a way to show their loyalty and their love for the brand. So brand love, if you've ever heard that marketing term, Harley has also been coined a subculture of consumption. So it's a group of people that have similar beliefs and ideologies around the consumption of a product. Other communities like that would be like Apple users, Jeep communities. If you're a Jeep person, if you've ever been ducked, I think that's a thing, putting little duckies on people's Jeeps. My mom has a Jeep. She gets ducked a lot.
Oh, I didn't know. Okay, wait. So people put little stickers of ducks on?
No, the little floaty bathtub ducks. You can get them in all sorts of style. And if you're a Jeep person and you see someone else that has a Jeep, you'll put a duck on their Jeep. I'm not a Jeep person, but my mom does get ducked quite often. I think it actually has a name, and I apologize, Jeep people. I might not be using the right terminology. But I've even seen people that own Jeeps where their whole front dash is full of ducks. Yeah, it's actually a thing. Yeah. But then they also have communities where they go out and they'll off-road together, and they have almost like car shows, their Jeep shows. And yeah, it's a huge community. But back to Harley-Davidson, it's a community like that as well. And so the women were wearing the apparel to show that they were a part of that community. And so it was a part of their identity, and they incorporated it into a lot of their daily life. And so they did go through some negotiations sometimes with having to meet dress code, let's say, right? Looking professional, but still being able to find pieces that maybe were not so heavily logoed, et cetera, that they could wear to work because they were that passionate about their lifestyle and that. But the other thing they do with apparel is they use it to commemorate as like a memory of where they've been. So like if you're a tourist and you go to, say, Yellowstone, you might take home a magnet or a pin to commemorate that you've been there. Oftentimes Harley-Davidson people will purchase t-shirts with the location on the back, and it says to others, hey, I've been there. I'm cool. And if you see a Harley person wearing Harley, that sends a message that you have something in common. And so it's also a way for them to bond with strangers, right? You might be sitting in a restaurant or a bar somewhere or something, and someone sees that you have a Harley shirt on, and they'll just start talking to you. And so it's a socialization thing as well.
Oh, thank you. That is great. The whole social aspect of clothing and how it brings people together. Thanks for explaining that. So a question I have, thinking about, okay, let's say that I wanted to become a Harley woman.
Yeah.
What would my look like? And what would my appearance be? What pieces of apparel would I don don to adopt that look?
Yeah. So there is what is considered a stereotypical image of Harley riders. And might be a leather jacket or a leather vest, some sort of leather. You want to have some leather's important. Leather boots are good because they would indicate that you ride, because you would wear those for protective. A lot of the clothing that Harley riders wear is actually protective. That would be your outer layer. And then your inner layer would probably be, again, more things that might speak to you as an individual. Some people like skulls. Some people don't like skull. So that's a common symbol that you might see. Number one is another common symbol in the Harley world. It's a little bit more race-oriented. I lean towards the racing-oriented symbolism of Harley-Davidson. Going fast. I like to go fast. And a screaming eagle is a symbol that motorcycle racers wear for NHRA, I think, is the motorcycle racing division. But yeah. And then colors are always important. Harley's known for orange and black. And so that might also make you more recognizable as the potential that you might ride a motorcycle.
Okay. Okay.
Or just love them and not ride them.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. That gives our audience a really nice kind of visual of what a woman that's embracing the Harley look would wear.
And of course, the logo is huge. At one point, Harley Davidson was bounced around number one, number two, most recognizable logo in the world. And it is a very recognizable logo. And it is also, if you think about tattoos, how many brand logos can you say that you've known friends would actually put that on their body? And people do that with a Harley Davidson logo. That's real brand love.
That is real brand love. Because I don't see, you know, Nike is another big brand that's very recognizable, but I don't see a lot of swooshes inked on people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Or Coca-Cola.
In fact, there was a comedy movie that came out maybe 15 to 20 years ago now. It was, I forgot, but they rode motorcycles. It had John Travolta and some other bigger actors in it. And I can't think of the name of it, but it's a funny in that it was a comedy movie. And one of the guys gets the Apple symbol tattooed on his arm. And it's a joke because you just don't really see that a lot, but you do in the Harley world. Yes. Lots of people have the symbol. So, you know, that's true brand. That's true brand power of a brand right there. When people will put that brand logo on their body, that's brand love at its finest.
That is. I mean, it's so interesting because you think about, or at least my recollection of Harley, there was a time where it wasn't that recognizable. Then I just remember it just resurging at one point and the retail stores opening up and just this whole resurgence of Harley. It was really cool to see that happen.
Yeah. Yeah. 90s. That was like the 90s. Yeah. It really exploded in the 90s.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really great. Your research on, you know, identity, self-expression, branding. So how do you bring what you learn research-wise into the classroom and working with students?
Yeah, like Farley just in general is like when I was taking my master's degree in branding and marketing and all of those types of things, Harley's in a lot of the books. And I was living it and was like living what I was learning. They would talk about a concept in class and I'd be like, oh, we do that. And it's great to be able to pull those examples into class that I've lived. But then also from the research part of it is I teach courses around branding and identity and sales. And so being able to use those examples in class is really cool. But I don't know how to tell you how. I think that every one of my students could tell you that they clearly know a lot about Harley.
Yeah. You probably have great stories and examples that you can share.
Yeah. And so it's not just all my research. It's also combined with my experience in the store and in that arena. I was in that for 12 years. This would have been my 20th year anniversary if I hadn't left Harley. This year would be my 20th year, but I was there for 12. Yes. And again, it crosses. And I've been riding Harleys for 30 years, riding my own for 20 plus, and about 25 now, I think I've been riding my own. And so it all melds together. It's hard for me to differentiate what I might pull from in class. But I was just talking to a student that was in one of my classes at the other university I taught at. And she was saying that she still remembers the video I showed in class that was a Harley-Davidson advertisement. And I was using it as an example for storytelling, brand storytelling. How, again, brands and consumers and she actually, I've actually had a couple students say that it gave them chills when they watched that video. And I thought that's cool. Yeah.
Wow. That's great. That is really great.
Yeah.
So thinking about your teaching and research, what types of projects are you working on now? Do you have some research projects that you're working on or teaching projects that you're working on that you can share?
I do, yeah. So again, I just, much like managing a brand and staying alive, et cetera, is just watching what's going on around you. And I'm currently conducting research regarding secondhand apparel. Is there still a link to identity when, and is there a brand connection? Is that potentially an avenue for brands to reach consumers? Because secondhand is such a big thing right now, and especially with the Gen Z generation, they have a focus on secondhand clothing and thrifting and things like that. Again, I see consumer behavior around me, and consumers are consuming branded products from thrift stores. And so I'm currently doing a study where I'm looking at that more in depth and trying to understand their behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll have to have you back after you have some findings on that too.
Yeah. Yeah. Because again, it can have, you know, it could have, it provide insights just into other brands as well, right? Just branding in general. But yes, I am focusing in on the Harley-Davidson brand again, because, you know, it's kind of fun. Yeah. Yeah. And I have some other thoughts in the background, consumer behavior related. Yeah. That I am looking forward to doing here in the future.
Oh, cool. Very cool. Well, I saw on social media that your students presented, I think it was yesterday, a concept for a store or a cafe that you're developing within your department or college at the University of Wyoming. Are you able to talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. What drew me to the University of Wyoming is that they were looking at opening a retail store on campus. And as I mentioned earlier in this podcast, I'm trying to help students make our industry stronger, right? And providing them with experiential learning and real life experiences when they're in a culture and environment that they can fail and learn compassionately, I think is important. And yeah, I'm excited to be out here. I'm helping open a retail store and a cafe for our department that will become an experiential learning lab for students. Yeah.
Excellent. You'll be excellent at that. And I will say, we worked together and at Iowa State, and you did that here and worked with students and faculty to open up a retail store here. So you have some great experience in that.
Yes, my experience with helping open that one is really is helpful here as well. I think both of them, my industry experience, it's the industry experience is a huge help. And has played a huge part in it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So one of the things we're trying to do here in opening the store is we've created an experiential course that the focus of the course, it will change over the course of 3-4 semesters, and the students are driving it. And so that has been so fun for me to empower them and to watch them make these decisions. So this semester, their goal was to create the vision so everybody around us could understand what the vision was and have a clearer direction. And yeah, yesterday they presented that. In the department out here, we also have an interior design program. And I do have exposure to visual merchandising as well. And I've been teaching it for many years now, or it feels like many years. But next semester, we'll have a more store design, visual merchandising, interior design aspect to it. And the students will actually be designing the space. And then, yeah. So that's going to be fun. And then I'm excited for spring 2026. That course, that semester, the course will be buying and product development. So we'll be working on the new products for both of the boutique and the bistro. And so, yeah, fun. Hopefully, goal is to have it open spring of 27, maybe a soft opening of late fall 26.
Oh, so it sounds like a good timeline. And part of your experience and what I experienced you doing here at Iowa State was student design or product development competitions. And you did student ones and alumni. And so how do you approach developing that? Because there's such great experiential learning experiences for students, but then also fabulous for their portfolios, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was going to say that's why I like doing it. Great experience, again, for the students. And again, can build their portfolios. And we're sending them out into the world highly competitive. And also, this is good ego booster stuff for them, right? So that they feel more confident in their abilities. So building their confidence too, when they go out into the world, I think that's a huge part of these experiences that we create is, yeah, we're giving them those skills, but also I think we're boosting their confidence, which sometimes I think people forget. So I'm excited to start doing product development again with the students and giving them that hands-on of learning what that looks like, because that's not always something that's easy for students to get, like internships in or an entry-level experience in. But yeah.
I so agree. And having that real world experience is important, and working with different entities. Back in the 90s, when I was at Colorado State, one of the classes I taught, we did product development project with the Children's Hospital of Oakland. And we designed silk scarves that were sold in their gift shop in Oakland, California. And the students that were involved with that, they went through that juried process too, of having outsiders. And this was, you know, this is the 90s, so we weren't as digital back then.
Well, to say that,
I know the ones that you've read were very digital oriented, and they handed it in. I had them drawing by hand, mocking up by hand, making a little presentation board. Then I took pictures of them, sent the pictures, or sent the boards to California, had them judge. And then we worked with a product developer and manufacturer in the Boulder area. It's just such a nice long history of opportunities in such various ways and different groups. So I'm getting up on my soapbox. I like to do that during the podcast and encourage educators to look at different entities. So it could be for your own entity, or we partnered with Children's Hospital in Oakland, California. I was in Fort Collins, Colorado. I mean, there was a little bit of a distance, and this was in the 90s when it wasn't easy.
Yeah. That's funny you said your soapbox, because as you were giving that, I was going to get up on mine. So now's my turn.
Okay, get there. I'll jump down.
Earlier, you asked me a question about digital, and we talked about AI and incorporating all this stuff. But think about the value and the level of education that your students still got by hand drawing and all of that, right? And so I was just talking about this to my students in buying the other day. I'm teaching you how to build these things in Excel. In today's world, that's rudimentary. You're going to have a computer that's doing this. But again, you need that more rudimentary base.
So
for you know what I mean? You can't devalue that rudimentary base, right? And yeah, we're building these in Excel, but when you get into your buying position, they're probably going to have a computer that can do your automatic reordering, but you might have to plunk in some numbers, and you need to know the importance of the number that you plunk in and the impact it's going to have on that reorder that's going to get set up for those jeans or, you know, whatever we're talking about, right? And even though you could do those things, those product development with AI today and things like that, right? Sometimes it's still nice and important to have the original skill.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to jump up on
your turn.
I'm going to jump up there with you because I so agree. And I had this conversation in the podcast episode with Jim Simon with Chloe 3D about the hand, and he was also agreeing. They're a huge technology company, but you have to have those skills. So I still believe in teaching manual techniques or really understanding those concepts. I love technology and I'm an early adopter and I'm all in, but I would not be able to use it as a tool. One example right now, I'm vibe coding. And I remember several years ago, I'd mentioned to some faculty that I felt that our students needed to have some basic coding experience in our department because I was attending industry trade shows and all of them were saying, code, you know, you need to be able to code, 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 code. I mean, this was food, restaurant, events, retail. I mean, I spent like 3 weeks at these different conferences and that's all I was hearing. And now, yes, you can vibe code and you can basically type in, I want you to create a website that looks like such a thing, and AI will develop this. But if you have to make changes and edit, you need to know some coding. Luckily, I know some basic coding. Not great, but at least I can look at it and not be scared. And so I agree with you that you have to have that foundational basic knowledge, or else if you work with Excel, and you just spit in numbers or you tell a program, just put some numbers in, but you don't know what they mean.
It's like I tell my students, again, a business term, garbage in, garbage out. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, audience, thank you for letting Amy and I get up on our soapboxes.
Thank you for tolerating us.
No, embracing us. And if you want to speed through this part of the podcast, go ahead.
Sorry, it's too late.
Well, looking back over your incredible, incredible career, what are some of the highlights that you're most proud of or excited about, or that you can share that could be inspirational to our audience?
I don't know. Yesterday felt pretty good. Just watching my students present their decisions. Yeah, their things. And actually, that's something that I developed when I was at Harley-Davidson, actually, as well. One of the things they'll tell you is you're only as strong as your team, and you'll be stronger if you build up your team, right? Okay. And it gets back to this compassion thing that I mentioned earlier, right? That this is truly who I am, but I had to realize that industry wasn't pushing me in allowing me to be who I am, right? Because it's so competitive, we people, managers, business individuals, we have a hard time lifting others up. And at a certain point in my career, which was when I was at Harley, I started deciding I wanted to lift each other up, other people up. And it is scary at first, because when I make you stronger as my assistant manager, and I often told my assistant manager this, you could do my job right now. You don't need me. And that can be scary, right? That can be scary to some people and not easy for them to do and lift others up. And I would say the best moments for me were when I realized that I didn't have to be afraid by lifting them up, and that I truly am stronger, and I get more pleasure standing over here watching someone else in the limelight And that, again, manifested itself yesterday with those students. All of the decisions, they made great decisions. They gave great recommendations. And just being able to lift them up and then watch them shine, right? Yeah, I would say that's probably the biggest achievements and enjoyment, I would say, that in my career. I've gotten a lot of achievements where I could toot my own horn. You know, I told you I started retail right out of high school. Within the first year, I was top sales. I've earned an award. Right? I have hard times sometimes promoting myself, right? Which gets back to your brand, but I know what I did. I know what I've done.
Absolutely.
I know what I'm capable of, right?
Absolutely.
Even that came around, even that kind of manifested itself when I got my PhD, because when I was in the classroom with the students, I didn't want them to call me Dr. Nichols. I wanted them to call me Amy, because I want us to be equal. We're a team. I'm working with you to make the best person you can be. And I've never had issues with respect, right? Sometimes, again, people, yeah. But I just tell students, I don't need you to call me doctor. I know what I accomplished. I know what I'm capable of. We're here to be a team. And I think that's probably what I'm most proud of, is lifting others up and then watching them shine, which was why I got into this in the first place, right? I told the students yesterday, I'd hire every one of you to work for me tomorrow, you know? And that's what I want. I want to put out good quality candidates that I would hire in a minute.
Absolutely. Well, what advice would you give to new professionals entering the industry? In just industry and period. It doesn't have to be retail, but just going out there into the world working.
Gosh, there's lots of advice. And some of it I'm stealing from guest speakers I've had in my class, which would be one, you know, never burn a bridge. Or if you burn one, you'd be very, very thoughtful before you do it. You have to build a bridge. But the world is small. We are in a world environment, but in a way it is still small, and every industry is small, and you make connections and you will run into that person again in your industry. And yeah, relationships are important. Relationships are important. That's a huge part. But do what's right for you and follow. Like I said, some of my struggles were that management was tougher on me because I couldn't be who I was as an individual. And I lost some of my compassion, but I've got it back now and I feel good about that. And yeah, so you just know who you are and be true to what you are. Probably the biggest thing I learned in that I love as well, and that guides me, is doing the Strengths Finder. I did that when I was in my MBA as well, and accepting what I'm good at and working in areas that I'm good at is where I should focus my time. And the things I can't do, hire someone else to do that for you. Live good at that, and there's nothing wrong with that. So I think that really even build my respect for diversity, is we are all good at something. But we're not good at everything.
No, we're not. And that's why teamwork and collaboration is so important. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, if people want to connect with you, learn more about your work, what's the best venue for that?
Yeah, LinkedIn. I'm there. You can find me. Reach out. Send me a message.
We'll make sure that it's listed in the show notes too. So our last question that we ask every guest is, how do you define innovation?
How do I define it? So just like I said earlier, I guess, would be keeping your eye on what's going on around you and being ready to pivot, being on your toes at all time, like watching a ball, playing a game, right? Keep your eye on the ball. And make sure that you don't just stick your head under the pillow and hide, because it's going to find you. Yeah. That ball's going to hit you. Make sure you're ready. And yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'd necessarily define innovation, but I would say you have to innovate. You have to stay moving and stay competitive and because, like I said, consumer behavior, the world, everything around you is constantly changing and evolving. And I guess that's what innovation is, changing and evolving. And you have to do that too.
Great definition. Thank you. Thank you. Very motivational too. So thank you for that. I really appreciate having you here. It's just been lovely chatting with you and hearing all of the projects that you're working on. So thank you for joining us today, Dr. Amy Shane Nichols.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. So to our audience, please, if you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, leave a review, share it with your network. This helps us support continuing to bring these powerful conversations to the forefront. And until next time, thank you for tuning in. Keep innovating, keep dreaming, and keep making a difference.